Ladies and gentlemen, could I encourage you to take your seats, please? Well, good evening. Welcome. It's great to see such a crowd here tonight. It's very encouraging because we've had quite a few functions over recent weeks, and the attendances have been universally sound, and that's a great credit to the members and bringing along new members and encouraging guests to come. So thank you very much for being here and welcome. Now, you've all heard about primacy and recency, haven't you? If you're trying to get a message across, you've got to get it across early, primacy, and then follow it up at the end, recency. So people go away remembering what you said first, and they have stuck in their mind what you said last. So I'm going to do that in relation to two of our upcoming functions. Firstly, China, Political Changes and Challenges. Professor Jeff Raby, the former Australian Ambassador to China, will be on next week at KPMG, and we would encourage KPMG supporting us very strongly in this, in Collins Street in Melbourne, and we want to get as many people there as we possibly can. So it's on Wednesday the 28th from 6 till 7.30 at 161 Collins Street, and we really do encourage as many people, I think they can fit in around about 200 or something like that. So that's a good encouragement to come along, and he of course is a very, very interesting fellow to listen to. So that's the first one, Political Changes and Challenges, Professor Jeff Raby. And the second one is our major event of the year, the Sir Salman Khan Oration, which is on Wednesday, the October the 12th, 2011, at 7:30 at the Australian Club, 110 William Street, Melbourne. And a very significant guest there, Mr. Dennis Richardson, the Secretary of the Department of Foreign Affairs in Canberra, Foreign Affairs and Trade. And Tony Walker is doing the appreciation for the Dennis's speech. So we'd love as many people as possible to be there as well. Jim Short, who's in the audience, is the organiser of this. Please get in touch with him. He's sent out messages recently, I know, but this is, again, an encouragement to come along yourself and bring a table or bring some guests. Now we come to the evening tonight. An interesting topic, I think, how the world sees Australia. And it's, I think, quite a major thing that we've got a Brit telling us how the world sees Australia.
I don't think we should stay.
The first sledge of the night.
Nothing changes. Nothing changes.
May 13th.
The question is he going to win?
Give him time. Give him time. Then. Order. House will come to order. Zig Bryant, the BBC's foreign correspondent in Australia. Well, he's been here for 5 years as the BBC's foreign correspondent and just finished his sojourn. But he's staying on because he's been a very intelligent fellow. He's married an Australian. He's producing children. How does the world see Australia? And you've seen the flyer. Do we live up to our self-image as a sun-blessed, relaxed, friendly and confident country? Or does the world see us in an altogether different light? Are we, as portrayed a decade ago by the American author Bill Bryson, an inconsequential country? Or are we seen as a major component of the global economic shift from the Atlantic to the Indian and Pacific Oceans? I read that Bill Bryson book, and one of the interesting things about it was he was travelling across between Hay Hill and Booligal, listening to the Test cricket, and it was being broadcast, and he thought that was rather a good thing to be doing. But we're now a member of the world's top economic body, the G20, a competitor for a seat on the UN Security Council. We won't take too much about that at the moment. A committed partner to our allies, a vital supplier to China and other fast-growing countries, and was the only OECD economy to avoid a recession during the GFC. But that's because we have the world's greatest treasurer, as announced today. Now, getting back to our guest speaker. Nick served as BBC correspondent in Washington and South Asia. He studied history at Cambridge, but finished off his education by going to Oxford, I'm pleased to say. He is the author of The Bystander, John F. Kennedy and the Struggle for Black Equality, and has just published a book chronicling his experience as a foreign correspondent, Adventures in Correspondent Land. A very experienced and well-travelled correspondent for the BBC. We're delighted that he's been in Australia and observing us for 5 years. We're delighted that he's staying on for a little while at least. And we're delighted that he's here to address us tonight. Would you please welcome Nick Bryant.
Thank you so much for that kind invitation, and thank you for all turning up. I'm overwhelmed by how many people are here. Listening to that flower, I must admit it actually reads better than my speech, which is slightly worrying. But how could a British journalist resist the temptation to speak on behalf of the rest of the world on the subject of how the rest of the world sees Australia? I'm glad you weren't deterred by some of my British forebears. So I think we're a tad harsh on this fine city. I'm referring here to the British author Robert Louis Stevenson, who noted, and I quote, "When I think of Melbourne, I vomit." Anthony Trollope, you'll be glad to hear, had a very different take. He called Melbourne the undoubted capital of Australia. Alas, that didn't happen, perhaps. But Melbourne has become, I think, the cultural capital of Australia. I certainly see it as the intellectual capital of Australia. This isn't being broadcast in Sydney, is it? And obviously, it's the sporting capital of Australia. Just a few weeks ago, I had the chance to speak at the MCG just over the way. It's always a nervous thing for an Englishman making his debut at the MCG, but people were very kind. And it was a kind of similar evening to this. And your great sporting cathedral looked absolutely beautiful that night. It was empty, and as the sun was setting behind the stands, these lights, these little sort of soft peachy light started illuminating the playing surface. It almost looked like a sort of intimate candlelit dinner. It looked absolutely gorgeous. And as I stood admiring the great jewel in Victoria's crown, my eye was drawn to the banner that was over the scoreboard. And it read simply, "Nothing beats Queensland." Well, nothing beats Melbourne, according to The Economist, who have just decided that this is the most livable city in the world. And that speaks of one side of what I want to talk about tonight, which is the rise of Australia. I also want to talk about the fall of Australia as well. In fact, I've entitled this speech, "The Rise and Fall of Australia." We'll get to that in a few minutes' time. I thought I'd just sort of explain how I came to be here. It does go back to the years in Washington. I was sent over to cover the Monica Lewinsky scandal. My bosses said, "Stay in Washington until Bill Clinton's out of trouble." I think they thought that would be a few months. I was there 5 years later, which says a lot about Bill Clinton. But we covered the Monica Lewinsky scandal, the impeachment crisis, his survival. Then, of course, that bizarre Florida election, the never-ending election with all those dimpled chads and pregnant chads. And then came 9/11 and the Bush administration's response to that. And I was in Washington then and spent 2 years reporting on the Bush administration's war on terror. And then when my posting came to an end, I decided I wanted to take a closer look. So I ended up in South Asia, covering countries like Afghanistan and Pakistan, seeing the sort of tip of the spear of the Bush administration's war on terror. Now, to be dispatched to the subcontinent as an unmarried BBC correspondent was to embark upon a journey that was pregnant with romantic possibility. The BBC had long offered a kind of nuptial variant on Nehru's tryst with destiny, and that was the almost certain thing that you would leave India with an Indian bride. It's extraordinary. Every single unmarried BBC correspondent who'd gone to Delhi had actually left a few years later with an Indian wife. I mean, oddly, the wife of Boris Johnson is a product of one of those unions. One of our veteran and great correspondents, Charles Wheeler, many of you will know him, fantastic correspondent, Washington correspondent in the 60s, he married an Indian bride. I slightly changed this tradition because I met my bride in India, but she turned out to be an Australian. And I fell in love with her. And I decided that I wanted to be with her, and she lived in Sydney and she had a business, so she couldn't move. So I went to the BBC basically and said, you know, I met this beautiful Sydney side, I'm going to move to Australia, thinking that would not only be a career limiting conversation but possibly a career ending conversation. And very happily they said, well, it's very bizarre you say this because we're just about to open up the job there. So the stars came into very neat alignment, and I managed to book my passage to Australia. Never before had I arrived in a country with such a clear and resolute sense of how I planned to cover it, or more to the point, how I didn't plan to cover it. I was determined to avoid stories about ravenous sharks, randy koalas, the rampant march of cane toads just didn't do it for me. There'd be no Antipodean animal stories. Neither would there be any stories about these kind of Crocodile Dundee-like characters. They wouldn't force their way onto railways either. And rather than shoring up Australia's creepy stereotypes with more buttressing, I was determined to target them with a wrecking ball. Then, within 3 days of starting my job, Steve Irwin was lanced in the heart by a stingray. And that became my first assignment. I found myself covering the very stereotypes that actually I was determined to avoid. And so I set off on my first trip out of Sydney to the Crocoseum at Australia Zoo on the Sunshine Coast, where thousands had gathered to celebrate the adventurer's outsized personality and his underdog success. It was an extraordinary event. Zoo hands lined the edge of the arena, cradling an assortment of Antipodean creatures in their arms. An elder from the local Gubbi Gubbi people delivered a eulogy in her native tongue and then led mourners in an ancient cooey wail. John Williamson, your great outback balladeer, sang True Blue, using the back of a ute as his stage. And you'll probably remember how the funeral service came to an end. It was with all the zoo hands taking sunflowers down to the crocoseum next to the pool where all the crocs were, that read out the word crikey at the end. And then Steve Irwin's mud-splattered ute was driven from the arena with his surfboard on the back. I mean, it was this kind of orgy of Aussiedom. And as I say, it was not the Australia that I thought I would end up covering. But the odd thing was that the Irwin death proved to be the perfect introduction to this confounding country. And the main reason why was because the death of Steve Irwin became an intellectual event and a cultural event. And it became part of that perennial debate that's long-running and anguished over your national identity. I mean, arguably, he became even a more confronting figure in death than he had been in life, because the question of his contribution to Australian life became the subject of an ever more rancorous quarrel. It began as an argument between those who saw him as the living embodiment of some of Australia's most celebrated values, courage, resilience, humour, larrikinism, mateship, and those who bridled at how this caricature of a man had become Australia's most bankable global brand ambassador. In the hours after his death, Russell Crowe started the ball rolling by describing him as the Australian we all yearn to be. But then came a counterblast from London, from one of the country's cultural castaways, and a woman who once laid claim, like Irwin, to be the world's most famous Australian. And I'm talking, of course, of Germaine Greer. She launched a ferocious attack on Steve Irwin for spawning what she said was a whole generation of kids in shorts, seven sizes too small, who would shout in the ears of animals with hearing 10 times more acute than them. And deliciously, there was a political edge to Germaine Greer's assault, because Steve Irwin had not only lauded John Howard as Australia's greatest ever Prime Minister, he'd also had what she described as a gala barbecue with George W. Bush. So now the wildlife warrior became a cultural warrior, and his fellow Queenslander, the novelist John Birmingham, leapt Irwin-like to his defence. He started by savaging Germaine Greer, a feral hag, he called her. a poorly sketched caricature of a harridan. Then he skewered the inner urban elite, which had viewed Irwin as what he described as a cashed-up bogan. So here we were in Australia's cultural wars with the usual battle lines taken up, like medieval armies observing some ancient rites. And what I was witnessing was Australia's very own clash of civilizations. Not so much the bush against the big cities, but the battlers against the elites, the lowbrow against the high. And for a newly arrived foreign journalist, it was hard to think of a more instructive initiation. The stereotypes I had set out to avoid had become the subject of feisty debates. The stereotypes were the story. And if nothing else, Steve Irwin's death demonstrated that Australia was far more complicated than international news organisations like the BBC preferred to think. We liked hearing, I think, about what I call an assumed Australia, one that recalled the usual stereotypes, one that wasn't confounding, one that was familiar. I suspect this is one of the reasons why big international news organisations have tended to neglect the land down under, a phrase itself which is dripping with inconsequentiality. I think generally they've tended to view Australia as this faraway backwater, where many of the stories, as F. Scott Fitzgerald might have put it, fell just short of being news. And long ago, Australia lost the veteran American anchor Walter Cronkite, much like LBJ lost him over Vietnam. He said, rather dismissively, Australia had too many journalists chasing too few stories. Another of his compatriots was Bill Bryson. And his book, Down Under, which is probably the most widely read portrait of modern-day Australia, really started off with your country's total irrelevance. He started his long journey here by taking the short trip to his local library. And he decided to check how many stories the New York Times had done about Australia that year. It was 1997, and Australia merited just 20 mentions. Albania, by contrast, got 150. And if anything, 1997 yielded an exceptionally rich harvest of Australian stories. Because I think over the next 6 months, just six stories were considered ripe for publication. And ending his adventures and travelogues, Bill Bryson left readers with a departing thought which was hugely melodramatic and also melancholic. Life would go on in Australia, he opined, and I would hear almost nothing of it. It was an extraordinary thing to say. My hunch was that this neglect was born of a false sense of understanding. The misplaced notion that because assumed Australia was so easily comprehensible, there was no real need for any further inquiry. It was almost as if we allowed Australians' tourism advertisements to do our journalism for us. Every few years ago, we'd see another one popping up to reassure us that everything we supposed was true. The blokes still drank beer. The women were still blonde, bikini-clad and beautiful. The Barbie was still aflame, like some Antipodean chariot of fire. And in my more evangelical moments, this was something I was determined to change, both out of national interest and self-interest. No longer should the tyranny of distance mean that Australia and its new resident correspondent would suffer the felony of neglect. So when I arrived in Australia, I planned to start with some of the contradictions and to then go from there, in the hope of persuading London that this truly was a continent that defied neat encapsulation. And I drew up a list of anomalies. How did the No Worries Mate Nation come to enter the new century with the third highest suicide rate amongst the world's rich club of nations, and see the consumption of antidepressant drugs triple over the past decade? How was it that such a supposedly laid-back country had some of the longest working hours in the Western world? Why the sanctification of the bush and the outback in one of the world's most urbanised countries? Why such a boozy reputation, and I'm looking at you with some of your wine glasses in your hand here, when in the world drinking leaves you have slipped to a lowly 20? It's pathetic, Australia. Though the championing of the underdog and the trumpeting of the fair go suggested that the spirit of egalitarianism still prevailed, Why had those nostrums not always been extended to the original occupants or the most recent arrivals, especially those conveyed by boat? Why did this fun and supposedly larriking loving land have such a zealous and overbearing bureaucracy? A question of especial pertinence to Paul Hogan, its most celebrated comedian and a tax fugitive. Call that a stereotype. My hunch was that we got Australia wrong. This wasn't so much a lucky country, and one of the things that I have done as BBC correspondent, I hope, is to say how misappropriated that phrase has been and how it has totally sort of divorced from the original Donald Horne intention. My hunch was to show this wasn't so much the lucky country, this country was the consequential country. And you just have to look at how international news organisations have totally transformed their coverage of Australia. The footprint for international news organisations is heavier than it's ever been. The BBC is here in force. Sky News have just opened up here. Al Jazeera English have just opened up here. The Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times, the Guardian, the Times, everyone is here reporting daily on what is happening. And let's return to the New York Times, the Bryson scale, perhaps we should call it. In the past couple of months alone, the New York Times resident correspondent in Sydney, they've got a resident correspondent here now, he's filed about 20 stories. That equals the number for 1997 in just a couple of months. And they're relevant stories, they're important stories, they're not crocodile stories, they're not koala stories. They're stories that talk about the consequentiality of this country. And my argument is that few peaceful nations with a population of 22 million people are getting anywhere near the amount of attention that you guys are at the moment. I really do believe that. You talk a lot about per capita sort of influence and per capita power, and in terms of news it's huge at the moment. So what have we been reporting on? Well, I think for the last 5 years we've been reporting on the rise of Australia. We've been talking about a country that is unrecognisable from that journalistic kingdom of the mind of old, a land good for the occasional and finally novelty story, a bizarre outback crime or two, and in the eyes of foreign news organisations, not a whole lot more. No. This really is a country where the tyranny of distance no longer implies this neglect. Indeed, the very phrase tyranny of distance is almost as much a historical relic, I'd suggest, as Ned Kelly's skeletal remains. Now that the locus of global economic activity has shifted from the Atlantic to the Pacific, proximity has become more defining than distance. The land down under is also likely to become redundant, that phrase that reeks of inconsequentiality. Instead, Australia is clearly in the right place at the right time. A modish phrase, I'd suggest, which over the next decade or so might even become the new national mantra. We are marvelling at your economy, this seemingly recession-proof economy, the much-vaunted wonder from down under, we are calling it, with your low public debt, your near full employment, your record terms of trade, a totemic currency, and a resources sector that's set to underwrite your prosperity well into this, the Indo-Pacific century. We also report on your much-envied economic model, with its watchful regulators, its risk-averse banks, and this distaste for irrational exuberance. True, we're no longer talking about a wonder from down under economy per se, we're talking about a twin-track boom and gloom economy, with the strong possibility that Australia has been contaminated by the Dutch disease. But most advanced economies are dealing at the moment with a gloom and doom economy, and afflicted by much more serious maladies like the Greek and subprime contagions. On the corporate front, I'd suggest companies like BHP and Rio Tinto will continue to attract the international eye. Their profits have become key Asian indicators and thus key global indicators. So too will the shopping giant Westfield, whose annual results are fast becoming another important economic barometer, much like the length of the queue of coal ships waiting outside Newcastle, the world's largest coal export port. I suggest the Macquarie Group has also become another much-watched Australian company, not least because it's expected to be the single largest non-governmental owner of infrastructure in the world. In diplomacy, Australia's rising influence has now become institutionalised, whatever becomes of your bid for a seat on the UN Security Council. Why? APEC and the G20, an organisation to which very few people paid much attention prior to the GFC, even bear the stamp of made in Australia. Kevin Rudd's prolific travel, first as Prime Minister and then more recently as Foreign Affairs Minister, may have raised eyebrows at home, but it's also raised Australia's standing abroad, and John Howard followed the same internationalist path. In terms of good living, Australia has become one of the great lifestyle superpowers of the world. It's a place that outsiders aspire to live in, and in the meantime, try to ape. Just visit a bookstore in London and see how many cookbooks and star guides come from Australian chefs and interior designers. One of Australia's biggest exports is an intangible that will never appear in the national accounts, and that's its sunny way of life. I always remember in the weeks before the British election, David Cameron was asked which programme he preferred, EastEnders or Coronation Street. He said, neither. I'm a Neighbours man. And we also talk about Tony Blair, as he's often been described as Britain's first Australian Prime Minister, partly because there was so much Australian influence in his background. Jeff Gallop, the former Premier of Western Australia, was a great mate of his at Oxford. Peter Thompson was a great spiritual mentor. Rupert Murdoch is a very close friend. He's often described as Britain's first Australian Prime Minister. And you see it in the kind of high Tony informality that has become his political style. In the arts and entertainment, I suggest, the cultural cringe has been superseded by the cultural creep. And I think here it's crucial to point out that most of the country's internationally celebrated artistic ambassadors speak or sing with an emphatically Australian voice. I'm thinking of Tim Winton, I'm thinking of Peter Carey, Christoph Celsius, Les Murray, Geoffrey Gummerill, Yunupingu. Indigenous art is respected internationally as never before. Cate Blanchett even had the audacity to take a streetcar named Desire to New York and get rave reviews. In recent years, especially, I think Australia's cultural infrastructure has started to rival its sporting infrastructure. Just witnessed GOMA in Brisbane. I don't know if any of you have visited that, but it's brilliant. Mona in Tasmania. The new National Portrait Gallery in Canberra. The new wing of the Museum of Contemporary Art in Sydney. And here in Melbourne, the Recital Centre. It's a fabulous building. So I think these things point to the rise of Australia. But we've also been talking about some negatives as well. I mean, still shocking to outsiders is the chasm in living standards between white Australia and black Australia. So I say this, this will sound slightly perverse, but I always look forward to my journeys into the outback, you know, partly because it was the only time in Australia that I truly felt like a bona fide foreign correspondent. The Northern Territory felt to me like a country within a country, where time seemed static and where what is a miserable inventory of statistics highlighted the glaring breach between white and black Australia. A life expectancy 17 years shorter, an unemployment rate 3 times higher, an incarceration rate 13 times as bad, run-down townships strewn with junk and the rusting carcasses of broken-down cars looked like they more rightly belonged in Soweto. Squalid living conditions suggested a developing nation rather than a top-10 ranking country. Not quite third world, but certainly not first. To visit an Indigenous community, for me, has been to cross over an invisible border. And the permit system that blocks unwelcome visitors operating in much the same way as the visa requirements of a sovereign state. Part of the problem for us is that the letters of welcome needed for entry were often controlled by local elders who frankly didn't want us to expose their communities to the prying eyes of the media, possibly because they themselves had something to hide. Once we spent almost a day waiting outside Mudajulu, the indigenous community in the shadow of Uluru, having been promised entry, and then seeing our invitation withdrawn at the last minute. And sympathetic as we are to the idea that indigenous communities want privacy and the diluted version of sovereignty that the permit system confers, it meant for us that Aboriginal Australia was sometimes harder to get into than Burma. And the irony is, of course, that indigenous communities suffer not from intrusion, but neglect. I call this the country's great flyover problem, ignored by so many people as they jet off to Bali or Europe. You know, the closest most many Australians come to an indigenous community, frankly, is from 30,000 feet. Another issue which is a negative and is incurring international reputational damage abroad is the asylum seeker issue. For us, numerically, the problem is comparatively small. Politically, the problem is disproportionately large. And for the BBC at least, and I think for other international news organisations as well, this isn't a numbers story. This is a reaction story. A boatload of, say, 37 Sri Lankan asylum seekers is never our headline. Rather, it's the kind of Pavlovian political response to each new boat arrival from the politicians in Canberra, and also from the media. The Sydney Daily Telegraph called the arrival of boat people in 2009 an invasion. It doesn't strike us that it is. Were there more news around, or were the economy in worse shape, then perhaps the problem would not loom so large. The press and the politicians would have something else to hyperventilate about. So on a number of levels, I think the boat people issue is what might be called a successful nation problem. Asylum seekers want to make their futures here, for obvious reasons. In the absence of major economic headaches, politicians are looking for wedge issues and other points of divergence. The press is in need of stories, especially ones that come with such strong pictures, which helps explain why boat people asylum seekers attract more media attention than those arriving by air, who obviously come here in far greater numbers. Now, tellingly, both of these negatives involve race. But we're not talking here of a redneck nation. For sure, racism, xenophobia, Islamophobia perhaps lurk close to the surface. But I've always made the case for Australian tolerance on this. I've always been struck by the success of multiculturalism here. It's remarkable to think that just after the war, over 90% of the 7.5 million people living in Australia were Anglo-Celtic. And since then, the population has tripled, with 40% of Australians having at least one parent born in a foreign country. And now, given the strength of nativism in the early history of modern Australia, given the durability of the White Australia policy until the late 1960s, surely it's remarkable that such massive demographic changes have taken place without unleashing an angrier backlash. Certainly I thought so. Part of the reason why the Cronulla riot was so jolting, it happened the year before I arrived and caused so much national introspection, was because these kinds of racist eruptions were so exceptional. To turn their trash talk back on them, could not the rioters themselves be described as un-Australian in their violent rejection of newcomers? Like Cronulla, the rise of Pauline Hanson, that blow-dried bogan Boadicea, appeared to confirm to international audiences that everything we thought about Australian intolerance was true. Yet Hansonism proved to be a very short-lived phenomenon, and its one-time figurehead is now a figure of fun. She became a contestant on Dancing with the Stars, a cast-iron proof, I suggest, of her has-been stasis. It has been impossible to ignore the evidence of intolerance. Not all of the attacks against Indian students here in Melbourne or Sydney were racially motivated, but we interviewed enough of the victims to know that the kicks and punches were often accompanied by racist abuse. Not all of the opposition to the construction of an Islamic school in the rural town of Camden, New South Wales, was based on raw Islamophobia. Yet it was hard to do the story complete justice without quoting the local Pauline Hanson clone, who feared her children might grow up speaking Islamic. For all that, much of what would be identified in other countries as racial intolerance, I suspect, could be more accurately characterized in Australia as racial insensitivity. It's a product not necessarily of dark-hearted malevolence, but flippancy, tactlessness, and the occasional misdirected Aussie sense of humor. A patronizing ignorance, if you like, rather than a sinister xenophobia. But whereas in other countries much of this kind of racial playfulness would be deemed politically incorrect, socially unacceptable, or plain insulting, in Australia it's often commonly brushed away with a laugh or a friendly punch to the upper arm. Racism here often comes with a built-in, it was only meant as a joke defence. This simply wouldn't cut it elsewhere. I think the Melbourne academic Waleed Ali puts it rather well in observing that Australia has a high level of low-level racism. To borrow two unlovely terms from the world of economics, the macro story is fabulously encouraging. On the micro side, it often gets a little bit more ugly. These are negatives. But when I talk about the fall of Australia, within the rubric of this idea of the rise and fall of Australia, I am essentially talking about your politics. And what we see on daily display in the nation's capital. And perhaps it can be dated back to the leadership changes we saw in 2009 and 2010. I'm talking here of the fall of Malcolm Turnbull and Kevin Rudd. If at times a great national drama, book titles, could be requisitioned and redeployed like merchant ships on the eve of war, the Australian ugliness, it seemed to me, offered the needed summation of Kevin Rudd's brutal demise. With the elevation of Julia Gillard, the country's first female Prime Minister, the 40th anniversary of Germaine Greer's The Female Eunuch became the literary touchstone. But for me it was Robin Boyd's opus, then celebrating its golden jubilee, that provided a timely epithet, if not an entirely accurate thesis. Ruminating on the schizophrenic streak in the national character, Boyd described his fellow countrymen as women as cruel but kind. When applied to Australian politics, however, his analysis was two words too long. It was simply cruel. Because he resigned on the morning of the leadership spill to save himself the embarrassment of a lopsided defeat, Kevin Rudd's removal came to be described as a bloodless coup. But it was bloodless in the same way that waterboarding is bloodless, a process that simulates drowning and thus near death, which leaves the body unblemished but the mind riven with scars. When Kevin Rudd appeared before the cameras a few hours later to tearfully bullet point his legacy, its effects were plain to see. Afterwards, an audit of Australian politics, quite frankly, took on the stench and the feel of a triage, a sifting of the wounded and the slain. The Bush capital had become a killing field. In the space of 40 months, Australia had seen four Liberal leaders and three from Labor. In New South Wales, the spiritual home of the Australian political ugliness, there had been four different Labor premiers in the past 5 years, and all with just one election. Of Louisiana, it is frequently said that a politician can survive anything, apart from being found in bed with a dead woman or a live boy. All it took in Australia in this phase was to wake up on four consecutive Monday mornings with a lackluster news poll. For a country jadedly stereotyped as chauvinistic, the supreme irony was that much of the watching world interpreted Julia Gillard's victory as a sign of political progress. Those who read the international headlines, Struth, there's a Sheila running Oz. That was my old paper, the Daily Mail. I started off as a tabloid reporter. It's not something I admit to very often in public these days. Would have been unaware of the macho factional chieftains lurking in the background, or that the back rooms of Australian politics were not so much choked with smoke as testosterone. Australia still awaited its first, its true political gender test, and that's the day when its chieftains were women. Julia Gillard had actually risen to power in a year cluttered with literary anniversaries, as well as being the 40th anniversary of The Female Eunuch and the 50th anniversary of the Australian ugliness. It was also 60 years since A.A. Phillips first noticed that listeners of an ABC program called Incognito tended to pick the outsider when asked to adjudicate between the performance of a foreigner and a homegrown musician. Nowadays, few vestiges remain of the cultural cringe. As I've said, it can proudly reflect on a global cultural creep. But instead, I'd suggest, it's been replaced by political cringe. Damning proof of that came in last year's federal election. The most insular, the most visionless, and the most low-caliber campaign I covered in any mature democracy on any continent. Mired in the marginal constituencies of the suburban fringe, it rarely broadened its gaze. Struck by the parochialism, the visiting British academic Neil Ferguson likened the campaign to Strathclyde local politics. Arguably, that was a little harsh on Strathclyde. The boat people question once again became the campaign's emblematic issue. And an outsider arriving midway through would have been forgiven for thinking that an armada of asylum seekers had besieged Australia. I took this slightly personally because the 2010 election made a mockery of the Australia that we've been talking about. Smart, sophisticated, warm, generous-spirited, and above all, consequential. And it was not so much that Australia had voted for irrelevance and mediocrity. By choosing Julia Gillard and Tony Abbott over Kevin Rudd and Malcolm Turnbull, the two major parties had made the decision for them. It brought us back, I suspect, to the point of departure for so much of the discussion on post-war Australia. Donald Horne's scorching polemic, Australia was his lucky country anew, blessed by an abundance of resources and cursed by second-rate politicians. So at the very moment when Australia is presenting such a confident face to the region and the world, the country's politicians give the appearance of turning away. When Julia Gillard told Kerry O'Brien that foreign affairs was not her passion, the rest of the world responded, I suspect, with the same indifference. Clearly, she has been nowhere near as globally newsworthy as her predecessors, Kevin Rudd, John Howard, Paul Keating, Bob Hawke, Malcolm Fraser or Gough Whitlam. You've had a run of globally significant leaders saying globally relevant things, and that has come to a halt. Tony Abbott has also expressed a preference for being a stay-at-home Prime Minister. He turned it into a campaign boast. And both leaders almost appear to revel in their parochialism and to reinforce it in each other. The major parties then are led by figures whose limited and increasingly immediate ambitions are happily accommodated within these shores. Tellingly, Colin Barnett, the Premier of Australia's most thrusting state, says he now spends more time in China than in Canberra. Seasoned observers know that ill-tempered question times and the hair-trigger ruthlessness of leadership spills has long been a feature of life within the capital circle. But it's the extent to which Canberra has become so thoroughly dominated by conflict that has spawned so much negative coverage both within and outside of Australia. That anger and hostility is often compared with the mood in 1975 throughout the Gough Whitlam dismissal crisis. But perhaps there's a late 1960s feel to it as well, that post-Menzies, pre-Whitlam interlude, when the country appeared to be treading water and waiting for something to happen. Certainly as I prepared to hang up my microphone as the BBC's Australia correspondent, I was struck by how many of the stories in my final week mirrored those of when I first arrived. John Howard, who continues to frame Australian politics in much the same way that Margaret Thatcher does in Britain, he reappeared. So did David Hicks. The most angry debates focus still on the governmental response to climate change and the governmental response to asylum seekers. Indeed, there seems to be a kind of standstillism that can't be explained away simply by the constraints imposed by a hung parliament. It also seems to stem from the warring styles of Julia Gillard and Tony Abbott, who seem locked in this continual trench warfare. That is why I have found it so hard to summon much enthusiasm for reporting on Canberra in recent times, and why it is probably time to stop doing so. For so much of my time here, I've reported with so much affection and so much love on the rise of Australia, but for the past 18 months, politics has been heading in completely the opposite direction. Thank you very much.
Well now, who would like to ask the first question? Yes, sir.
Question, Mr. Bryan. Do you see the conflict in Canberra as more significant, more vicious, more depth than the conflict in Washington between the executive in the legislature?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting parallel, actually. And Julia Gillard's made it, hasn't she? With,
I don't know.
Well, she's been talking about the Americanisation of politics. And to have been in Canberra recently on those, some of those demonstrations, there is a bit of a Tea Party feel to them, to be honest. A kind of people's revolt, as Tony Abbott's described them. I think whenever you criticise Australian politics, a lot of people make the assumption they're actually suggesting that British politics is better. I don't think it is, necessarily.
Question time is better.
Question time is better. No, it's very interesting to see the response, actually, when I think ABC showed the parliamentary debate after the Murdoch hearings.
That's right.
And there was a lot of people who thought, well, that's a quality debate. In fact, you even, I think Mark Scott, the head of ABC, started a sort of Twitter campaign to get John Bercow, who's a Speaker of the House of Commons, over to Canberra. And I think there's a lot of people in Westminster that wouldn't mind seeing that happen. He's not a particularly popular figure. I think there's a real problem in Washington. If I'd been delivering this speech in Washington, I speak about this in my book, actually. Washington faces huge problems at the moment, not only the size of the deficit, but the impoverishment of its politics. I think Washington has almost reached the point of ungovernability, with the separation of powers, the supermajority needed to do anything in the Senate, the House based on two-year terms, and most of the seats not contested, really. Your main danger will come from within your party in the primary process, which obviously encourages this kind of hyper-partisanship that we're seeing in Australia, in American politics right now. So I think that, and those problems are reinforcing the debt and the quality of the politics. I mean, when Rahm Emanuel goes to Chicago to kind of escape the kind of heat of Washington, I mean, if Chicago is your safe refuge, then you're in real problems. And he had a very neat way of describing Washington. I'm not sure if I can repeat it in polite company. As ever with Rahm Emanuel, involved a swear word, but it was F Nutsville. That's how he described it. I think it was a great story about Rahm Emanuel. There's a joke that if ever he had his middle finger amputated, he wouldn't be able to communicate. But anyway, no, I think the problems are huge. I slightly worry as well. I think Julie Gillard's got a point. You know, it was slightly worse when Sky News has just launched a program called Showdown. I mean, again, politics is conflict. CNN actually went in the opposite direction. They used to have a program called Crossfire, and they got rid of it. Jon Stewart, the American comedian, went on it, and he hammered it to the point that they actually, it became a kind of toxic brand almost. So I think that's a problem. I mean, Q&A as well, I think. They often try and set up these conflicts. You know, they'll have Greg Sheridan next to John Pilger in the hope they'll kind of have an on-air punch-up. And again, you know, politics and public debate is conflict. And I think there's an anger and a sort of nastiness creeping into the public debate. That's not a good thing, and it does replicate what's happening in America. And I do think that Washington's got even more serious problems in Canberra.
There's a question, Tim. Sorry, yeah, down, Bob.
Good day. that was a very interesting talk. I've got three points here, and they're going to lead to a question. We're talking about the Indigenous Australians, and this is no joke. This is a very, very big problem for Australia. I was born in Darwin, and we have a lot of them up there, but there are three difficulties. One is alcohol. The Indigenous elders opposed giving them alcohol when, in whatever it was, 1936, we went off to the south for 6 months on a boat in that, and a cyclone had blown our front door off, and my dad had never put it back. No one came in, nothing was stolen, it was pre-alcohol days. Mm-hmm. Alcohol was a transformation of the Indigenous problem. The next thing was blood was a problem. Hermannsburg Mission, I was talking to a guy there, and he said when they got their first Indigenous priest there, he was given a mission card. He had to leave for Alice Springs at 4 a.m. in the morning because people of his group had a right to whatever he had. And they would get on his car and overload it because he had no leverage ability to say no. So he had to get up at 4 a.m. in the morning, not publicise his trip, and go before they found out he was going.
Oh, can we get to the question now?
Yeah, yes. Number three.
No, the question.
When an Aboriginal dies, they cannot live in that house again. Now, the question is, how can we well-meaning persons, and those well-meaning persons, how can we bridge this enormous gulf between their lifestyle and our lifestyle? Now, that was the question.
Thank you.
Now, I think about... talking about Indigenous affairs in the context of a kind of talk like that, you run the risk, and you know, I accept blame on it for sounding incredibly glib and for reducing what is an extraordinarily complicated problem into a kind of collection of sound bites and sound thoughts. You know, we've spent a lot of time in reporting from Outback Australia. I totally agree with that, the alcohol problem. I mean, if you go to Alice Springs, it's a huge, huge problem. And Alice Springs has tried to do a great deal to sort of limit it, you know, raising the price of alcohol, making it unavailable at certain times. Obviously, the intervention has banned alcohol in the townships around Alice Springs, on the fringe of Alice Springs, and other Indigenous communities. So it is a huge, huge thing. How do you go about solving it? I mean, one of the problems, I mean, is the kind of political insignificance is the wrong word, but yeah, you know, Aboriginal Australians don't represent the same sort of voting lobby, or haven't got the same kind of clout in Canberra as perhaps, you know, you'd like. I often wonder, for instance, what would have happened if we'd had this hung parliament situation and it was an Indigenous MP from the Northern Territory who held the balance of power. You know, perhaps that would have done something about it. Because it doesn't strike me that it's a pressing national issue. It's an important national issue, but it's not a pressing national issue. So perhaps there has to be this kind of reorientation and a reprioritisation. You know, I was at the apology, and it was an extraordinary day. And it was, frankly, the best thing I think I've reported on Australia in terms of, you know, the emotive power of it. And I always remember we'd lined up Barnaby Joyce to speak on behalf of the sorry sceptics afterwards, and we were there on the lawns of Parliament House, and Barnaby Joyce came out and his eyes were red. He'd been crying, this great spokesman for the sorry sceptic movement, and Barnaby Joyce had been moved by it, and it was an extraordinary day. You know, the criticism obviously of the Aboriginal community is that was symbolism and hasn't been backed up with sort of substantive action. And I know a huge amount of federal money goes into this and a huge amount of federal thought, but perhaps it needs to be a higher national priority. The other great memory that day is to see Aboriginal women walk in with black t-shirts blazoned with the word sorry, and then come out with black t-shirts and blaze them with the word thanks. It meant so much to them, and it was a fantastic moment.
Yep. Mike. I'm moving from side to side.
Sir, it was wonderful to hear your very enthusiastic review of Australian progress over the last 20 years. I'd like to ask you this. I remember in the 70s and 80s, we had very close relationships with our next-door neighbours. McEwen developed the treaty with Japan, which led to a huge increase in Australian Japanese trade. We orchestrated the development of Petaling Jaya in Malaysia. Later, the New Zealand Free Trade Agreement resulted in New Zealand, which had a great deficit trade with Australia, now exports and imports between the two countries are more or less balanced. We had a number of ambassadors in Indonesia who were regarded as the epitome of ambassadors between two countries. When I look at the situation now, I see a very different situation. I regret to say that the relation between Australia, Indonesia, Malaysia, even New Zealand, seems far removed from those halcyon days. When you think that we have 300...
Is there going to be a question?
What do you think of Indonesians around our north? How do you see the future? That is a key problem, I think, for everybody here.
Yeah, and it's one of the ironies, isn't it, that you had a very sort of Asia-centric Prime Minister in Kevin Rudd, and actually the relationships with all those countries during that period probably went sort of slightly downhill. One of the things I should have spoken more about is the Asiification of this country. I've never lived in a country, frankly, that's pulled in so many different directions. You know, you've got this umbilical relationship with us. And Australia still seems to be very, very British, to be honest. I think the slow death of British Australia is really noticeable. And it strikes many outsiders as odd. You know, the Queen's still the head of state. You've still got majestic coinage. You've still got a Crown Prosecution Service. After the bushfires, there's a Royal Commission. I was reporting on the Bushfire Memorial Service, and the first person to get a round of applause was Princess Anne, which is interesting. You've still got this great strategic relationship with America, obviously, and that's the basis for your defence. But you know, one of the interesting things to report on over the last 5 years, obviously, is the sort of Asiification. And you're probably seeing it being conducted at a more rapid pace in the economic sphere rather than the sort of diplomatic sphere. And I mean, Kevin Rudd's great idea of an Asian, you know, organisation to rival the EU just lasted about as long as his speech, didn't it? It didn't go anywhere. But I mean, clearly that's going to happen. I mean, that example of Colin Barnett is fascinating. I think he spends more time in China now than you've seen Qantas, your national carrier, totally reorientate itself in the last few weeks. When you actually applied for the World Cup bid, you did it based on your proximity to Asia, and it was all based on being the gateway to Asia. So it's all interesting to see how these things are playing out. I mean, no doubt many of you have read Michael Wesley's latest book, There Goes the Neighbourhood. And his great criticism, obviously, is that Australia isn't embracing Asia anywhere near to the same extent. And he speaks of the disrepair of some of those diplomatic relations with America's close neighbours. He talks about, you know, the teaching of Japanese, the numbers learning Japanese now has really gone down. Your diplomatic footprint, I think, has been shrunk a little bit in the region. You're not spending as much money as he'd like on things like the Australian network, which could be extraordinary for sort of projecting Australian soft power. It is interesting to... You know, your future clearly lies in Asia, but I totally agree that some of those diplomatic relations, they've gone in the opposite direction as well.
Could we make the question short, because we've run...
And I'll make the answer shorter as well, sorry.
Michael Hellman's tried very hard to get a question.
Mr. Bryan, you touched on this, marrying up...
Please call me Nick, Mr. Bryan's very formal.
Marrying up this experience in America and Australia, the common perception of Americans is that they're very xenophobic and nationalistic. My experience of covering the world is that all countries are. Where would you put Australia in that spectrum of xenophobia and nationalistic? In your experience of having
traveled? I think it's interesting actually how the Hey It's Saturday debate played out in the two different countries, and the fact that it was an American on the panel who kind of raised that. I spoke about how the allegation of Australian racism to me is often more valid as an accusation of racial insensitivity, and I think you get that more in Australia. You know, it was Harriet Connick Jr. who complained that night. And it was the Americans that made the story such a big deal. I mean, it was playing huge in America. Oddly, Julia Gillard was there at the time. I think I've got here actually what she said. Because she kind of wrote it off. She said, you got to realize that was Aussies being Aussies. And in Washington, you know, in a place with a black president, that sounded a bit weird. Here it is. She was visiting Washington at the same time. She explained that the skit where five black men are blacked up as minstrels was meant to be humorous and would be taken in that spirit by most Australians. It wasn't taken in that spirit by a lot of Americans. So I think there's a kind of sensitivity around race in America that perhaps works in a different way here.
Thank you.
But like I say, I mean, I still think the big story about race here is one of great success. I think the big story is this remarkably successful assimilation and multiculturalism. I mean, you see it here in Melbourne. I mean, this is one, it strikes me, one of the reasons why it's one of the most livable cities in the world is because it's one of the most multicultural countries in the world and one of the most successfully multicultural countries in the world. That was the paradox, frankly, about coming down here to report on the Indian students being attacked. Because if there's one city in Australia, frankly, I wouldn't think it would happen, it's here.
Right, down the back behind Michael Hellman.
Nick, I just have to ask you a little question about the role of the BBC. With kind of the New World scandal and the attraction of many news organisations in Australia, do you think that foreign correspondents really have a future anymore? Or do you see the different kinds of news?
Well, I must admit, whenever I use the Walter Cronkite phrase, there are too many journalists chasing too few stories. I'm not sure if that's a useful thing to say these days in these cost-cutting times. I've used that phrase a couple of times at a panel discussion sponsored by the Media Alliance Union, and it was a terrible thing to say, a conference sponsored by a journalistic union. Do foreign correspondents have a future? Yeah, of course. I mean, never more so. I'd suggest the role of the foreign correspondent has never been more important. I think one of the really interesting things that has changed is the kind of balance of power now between your base and your bureau. And the information age has really changed that. Because people are getting, you know, often I'll be in a news situation where the people in London are actually getting more information than I am. Because they've got access to all their plasma screens, they've got access to their Twitter feeds, they've got access to the newswires. They've got access to the internet. They're getting this sort of huge sort of glut of information. But I'd always argue that, you know, information is very different than journalism. And the gap between the two, and that area between the two, is where foreign correspondents sort of do their stuff. And, you know, there is something to be said for immersing yourself in a country for 5 years, reading its newspapers, listening to its programs, reading its history. And explaining to the rest of the world what is happening, rather than, you know, London now sort of often think, well, you know, we can read the Sydney Morning Herald, we can read the Australian, we just do it online. But, you know, like I say, there's very different from having that information available and journalism, and that's the role that foreign correspondents still have. You know, I think our business is going through huge changes, and not all of them are good. And the technological changes that have overtaken us in the last 10 years are just extraordinary. When I was in the Washington Bureau, we had two mobile phones that we used to have to sign out. But, you know, when I joined the BBC, I was presented with a razor blade and a piece of sticky tape and reel-to-reel tapes. And we had these German tape recorders. They were like breeze blocks, and they were called Ewers. And all BBC correspondents had what we called the Ewer droop, because they carried them on their shoulders. They were so heavy that after a while you had to balance them every now and then. Nowadays the technological changes are amazing, and what I'd suggest is actually that the best thing that ever happened to foreign news is our ability to broadcast from anywhere at any time. We can do it now with a computer like that, the size of a breakfast tray. And the worst thing that ever happened in foreign news was our ability to broadcast from anywhere, anytime, because we're expected to do it. And again, you know, this idea of patient observation in this age of kind of instant news and news cycles that have just gone zoom is a real problem for us.
I was listening to you on the radio driving up here talking with Linda Byrne. One of the things that was mentioned was this program, this comedy show that's on ABC at the Lodge, you know, about Julia.
At Home with Julia.
Yeah.
Yes.
And somebody speculated that really it was no different from Yes Minister. I feel it's very different because Yes Minister is not about a real person, it was a sort of, you know.
Right.
So my question is really, do you think that there's a greater lack of respect in the media here for our politicians than there is in other countries? And has that contributed to our very low opinion of people in politics?
Well, I'd repeat what I said in that programme, actually, which I always think political satire really works when the target of your political satire is politically strong. And Spitting Image was fantastic during the Thatcher years because Thatcher was so dominant. And actually, Spitting Image and the Labour Party, which was the opposition at that time, was so weak that Spitting Image, in some ways, was a kind of opposition. Where I don't think political satire works so well is when it targets the politically weak. And for everything I've said about Julia Gillard tonight, and I haven't been flattering, it strikes me as a bit merciless and to go after in this way. The problem about politicians saying this, I mean, I was amazed, for instance, to hear a Liberal MP saying, what we need is more are you being served, which was fabulous. Anyway, talks about the slow death of British Australia. But the one thing with politicians saying, you know, this is disrespectful to us, goes back to what I've said in the speech, which is politicians in Australia right now are bringing a lot of disrespect to themselves. The video nasty that is coming out of Canberra comes out on a Monday to Thursday every sitting week in Parliament. It's called Question Time. And I'd say that's far worse to watch than, or far more, should be far more of a national worry than half an hour on a Wednesday night with at home with Julia. I must admit, I hadn't watched it until 3 o'clock this afternoon. I must be the only journalist in Australia who hadn't. But I didn't think it was very good as well. I thought it was really lame, and I thought some of the jokes were really laboured. Anyway.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's just about 7 o'clock, but there's a lot of hands up around the place. Would you like to stay on for a couple of minutes? Right.
One here.
One here.
Thank you very much. One of the ways that Australia, when you talk about the fall of Australia, one of the ways it's ranked historically poorly.
I should have asked you, are you okay to stay on for a little while?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah.
I'll keep going.
No.
Isn't its media freedom ranking? It comes up 59th in the world. What effect has the
It's media
ranking in the world? In terms of media freedom. Press freedom is ranked quite poorly in Australia, 59th in the world. To what extent do you think has a concentration of media in two Fairfax and Murdoch's hands had an effect on the politics and freedom of discussion in Australia?
That's a remarkable stat. I didn't know that.
There you go.
No, I'm fascinated. That's really extraordinary.
It's really extraordinary because Australia does so well in all the rankings. It's the only ranking it does poorly on is press freedom. Because it's owned by CBS.
Yeah, I'd love to read more about that. The debate works differently here than it does in Britain. I mean, I was obviously asked to report on the Murdoch side of things from here. I was actually in London that week. It was extraordinary. I've never known a week in London like it since Diana died, frankly, in terms of its weirdness and in terms of its reallocation of power in a way. I mean, you know, arguably nobody has had so much power for so long, uninterrupted, as Rupert Murdoch, apart from the Queen. And that was why there was a parallel between the 2 weeks. There was a strange week in London. But I was asked to report on it here. And, you know, my main point was the difference was the criticism of the Murdoch press here is editorial rather than ethical. And that stems from the concentration of ownership. You know, what have you got, 70% ownership? So that's the major difference. I mean, in terms of ethics, I think Australian journalism is really, really very strong. But no, there is clearly a diversification of ownership difference here. But if you want that discussion, actually, Robert Mann is doing something down the road. He's at the Wheeler Centre. He was supposed to be with Paul Kelly tonight. They were supposed to have a big ding-dong, which I thought everybody would go to, frankly. And Paul Kelly sort of ditched it at the last minute, apparently.
Yep.
Robin, can you tell me what
Well, Julie Gillard was born in South Wales, very close to where I was born actually. I'm not Welsh, but I was born over the other side of the Bristol Channel, in a place called Barry, which was where I used to go on Sunday school outings. Tony Abbott was born in London, and he was born in London, yeah. Yeah, and he spent, I think, 6 months there. Yeah, his parents were Australian. I mean, we're not claiming ownership on Tony Abbott. But the British influence, arguably, on Tony Abbott wasn't where he was born. It's where he went to university. And that was Oxford. And
you?
Yeah, I did. Right. And there's some lovely stories about nobody boxed at Oxford. It was daft. You got beat up all the time. They used to have these town versus gown boxing bouts. It was just like a bloodbath. The great story about Tony Abbott at Oxford was that whenever he jumped into the ring, he imagined his opponent was Bob Hawke. Which speaks to the problem. But anyway, the question was, do we take any blame or
no.
Are we culpable in any way?
No. Does that affect the way they project their image about their associations?
Well, I mean, despite his where he was born, and despite the bit of where he was educated. I mean, Tony Abbott is such an Aussie, isn't he? I mean, you know, no British guy would be seen in those kind of budgie smugglers, I promise you. And Julia Gillard's such an Aussie as well. Again, I don't see much Brit in them, to be honest. Apart from Tony Abbott's love of the monarchy, of course. That's the key thing.
Man over, he's been waiting for ages.
Relevant follow-up there, and I think, having been an expat myself, I think expats do obviously sometimes make a conversation. There may be a little bit of that going on, certainly with Julian, I suspect. But my question to you is, if you'll forgive what is a slightly personal question, is, having lived in Australia for some years and having married an Australian, would you consider taking an Australian citizenship?
What a fantastic question. I think I'd fail the citizenship test. I've had a look at it. Some of those questions are really tough.
Bradman is the answer to at least one.
But there are... it's the Walter Lindrum question, which catches a lot of people, apparently. Who was your great snooker player from the 1930s? And I know that because I when I'm in Melbourne, I often stay at the hotel just down the road. It's a great hotel. Would I ever take up Australian citizenship? Well, there are kind of logistical reasons why it would be very helpful. There are sentimental reasons why it would be problematic. But my son's Australian. As I was saying earlier, I haven't got around to doing the paperwork necessary for him to have a British passport at the moment. So he's 100% Aussie at the moment. So, yeah. But, I mean, you know... one of the funny things, I mean, this kind of Anglo-Australian rivalry plays in a different way now. And I oddly think that the rivalry means more to the Brits now than the Aussies. And we're talking about this little rise of Australia. I think it's one of the reasons why, one of the areas that it's actually reflected in. I think we're still flattered as Brits that the Aussies sort of still care about the Ashes and still keep the rivalry going. Because we don't get a lot of attention from our other former colonies, quite frankly. I mean, America doesn't really care anymore. Canada cares about America. India cares about China. You know, you're one of the few people that still, that sort of rivalry and umbilical collection still matters. And I think it speaks of us rather than it speaks to you. I mean, whenever I hear the Barmy Army sing, God Save Your Queen, I always think it reflects more on them than you. And this need to kind of, you know, we're still in that kind of Dean Acheson, you know, lost an empire, still figuring out a role. And it kind of, it pleases us that Australia's, that rivalry still matters, because for so many other people it doesn't.
Well, the compromise I came up with, and I hold both because I'm just effectively in the same position as your son is.
Right.
A British mother, but I have been sitting here, but I refuse to take British
mother. Ah.
That's how I justify it.
Oh, that's a neat formulation. I must try that. I have to say, actually, my son cries whenever he sees green and gold. He's been trained to that extent. He loves the Ashes. See, I can't help myself. I sledge myself. Yeah.
Right, yeah, yeah, and then over there.
Yeah, Nick, I just recently went to a seminar, like 10 years on from Tampa, and one of the speakers was the writer David Marr, and he had quite a depressing take on it, and saw the decline of the debate basically in Australia. But he saw that the only way that Australia would come to a more humane solution for the asylum seeker issue could only come from the Liberal Party.
Right.
Champion within the Liberal Party. That's the only way that could be defeated, which I thought was quite interesting. So my question to you is, what do you think about that in particular? But also in general, like, what do you see as needed to lift the political debate back up again?
Yeah, I'm on the first one. I mean, it's extraordinary the extent to which Tampa still sort of casts a shadow over electoral politics in this country, and the fear that Labour will be, I mean, so much of their policy is obviously the fear of being deemed to be soft on border protection, and that the success with which John Howard used that issue in 2001 in that election. I suspect possibly the moment has passed for a kind of sensible conversation at the moment, and it won't happen for a while. And I suspect that moment probably was when Kevin Rudd was having those sort of stratospheric approval ratings, that he faced Malcolm Turnbull on the other side. And they play politics to that issue to a certain extent, but it looks like shadow boxing compared to the cage fighting that we're now seeing. And I think that was the moment when there could have been a kind of more sensible national conversation about it. And I suspect you're right, it's going to take a Liberal leader to kind of call the truce in a way. and given the success of Tony Abbott. I mean, that's the kind of, you know, I talk about the brutality of the politics at the moment, and, you know, the problem is for Tony Abbott is working. I mean, he's on the verge of returning to power now. And the headline story from all the polls, which show Julia Gillard's approval ratings nosediving, and his approval ratings getting higher, is obviously, you know, Julia Gillard's on the skids. But the other thing that the polls show is that most Australians would prefer to see Kevin Rudd back and Malcolm Turnbull back. Every single poll this year has shown that. So I sense there's an appetite for a different kind of political conversation. You speak about how it will change. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think there are all sorts of problems with politics at the moment. The professionalisation of politics is a global phenomenon. I do think there's a sort of calibre issue at the moment. And you wonder where the kind of new blood will come from. There's a few people that are really interesting to watch at the moment. I think there's a guy called Andrew Lee, who's a Canberra politician, Labour guy. Yeah, Harvard PhD, big brain economist for Man U. And he's writing some really interesting books at the moment. And crucially, he kind of avoided... The way he got into Parliament was to kind of go around a kind of pre-selection fix. So the union guy, whatever, who was supposed to get that seat didn't, and he did, and perhaps that's what it needs. I'm always struck by my list of Australia's most impressive people doesn't marry up with the membership of Parliament. And also on that list of Australia's most impressive people, I've often met a lot of people who tried to get into politics and they never got past pre-selection. And I think that's a problem that somehow has got to be addressed.
Question over here.
It wasn't mine, but you'll have to tell us who was on your list.
Well, I mean, frankly, so many people are in commerce, you know, industry, commerce. Who have I met recently who's fabulously impressive? And I mean, people like Heather Riddow, you know, I mean, she's a really smart woman. And I shouldn't sort of, you know, name. It's not for me to kind of come up with a list of favourites, but you know, often they're in business, they're in commerce, they're in education, they're in the arts. Some of them are in the media, but often they find it difficult to make the move into the politics. And then partly it's such a problem with pre-selection at the moment. And what I talk about, which is this professionalisation of politics.
Is it one? You all done? All sold? All gone? Well, Nick, thank you very much indeed.
Well, thank you. I hope I was nice enough, by the way.
Probably the only miscalculation you've made is that you've given a former politician the right of reply. Now, I thought it was an outstanding speech, and from the interest of the audience and the questions, the multiplicity of questions, obviously it was regarded that way as well. Can I fill you in on a couple of things, though? We do regard the Ashes as very important.
More important.
Well, we'll see, because we're going through what is known in the trade as a rebuilding process, I believe. I read about it in the papers, so it must be right. So we do regard these things as important. And one of the things that I've found over the years, travelling around the place, it's not bad to be not taken too much notice of, not regarded too highly overseas, because it gives you an advantage when you're up against the people who are not taking it too seriously and not taking you as being capable of dealing with the issues that you have to deal with. And you find that in all areas of endeavour. So Australians have still, I believe, got a very strong sense that they can do anything. We strongly believe that we've got the best soldiers in the world. We used to have the best tennis players. We don't anymore. But we've got a few other things going for us as well. So the underlying, I think, there is a strong sense that Australia's got a bit of a future. But you're right about the politicians. And you've given us a real drubbing tonight, and I think we've deserved it. There's a couple of former politicians in this audience here, and I can tell you a little bit about politics. One of the things you've said, it's too hard for people to get pre-selection. It is very difficult for anybody to be pre-selected unless they are a favourite son or daughter of some particular power group
to get into, is pre-selected for a seat, a safe seat in the federal parliament. Very difficult, and the same applies, I think, to state parliaments as well. So it is difficult to get pre-selection. One of the other things that put people off going into politics is the lifestyle of the politician and the scrutiny by the media, dare I say, of politicians' lives. And so you've got to be pretty strong in your own belief that there's nothing in what you've done in the past or what you're doing at the present time that can stand up to the sort of inquisitorial scrutiny that is applied to politicians these days. It's a pretty tough life out there if you're an active and participating politician to get away from that type of unrelenting inquisitiveness of the media and how that can be misrepresented or presented to the general public. So there's quite a disincentive for people, for really good people, to go into politics because you can do much better financially outside of politics and you don't have to go through that sort of total inquisitive inquiry into your personal life. So there's a couple of things that that impinge upon them, but don't write them off. They're in there, as we say in Australia, having a go. Whether they're in the UK or the US or here. So it's been an absolutely delightful evening, and it's wonderful to hear a person with the command of the English language that that you embody. And it was really delightful to listen to you, and we've learned a very great deal. So thank you very much indeed. Would you join me?